King Solomon wrote, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all thy getting, get understanding." He therefore establishes a link between wisdom and knowledge. Wisdom indeed has been defined as the beneficial application of knowledge. The beneficial application of knowledge. Now we know, of course, that sometimes we get things right without knowing what we're doing. Like me this morning with the computer. I hope it works. Well, how it works, I don't really know. In those events, it's really a fluke, isn't it? But the admonition here is that get understanding, get knowledge, so that we can rightly apply that knowledge to our benefit. We are then acting wisely. Of course, King Solomon was well qualified to write those words. He was quite well qualified to say wisdom is the principal thing. Because as we read in 1 Kings chapter 4 and verses 29 to 31, "And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding exceeding much, and largeness of heart, even as the sand that is on the seashore." And Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of... Sorry, what happened there? As I say, this morning, things happen by fluke sometimes. Never right. And Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the children of the East country and all the wisdom of Egypt. They're powerful statements, aren't they? "For he was wiser than all men. His fame was in all nations round about." Consequently, it is not surprising that he wrote the words of Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 13. "And I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. Being such a wise man, it is natural that he would use that wisdom to try to search out all the things that are done under heaven." Now, some of the things that he did in his search are recorded a little earlier in his letter, in Ecclesiastes. For example, in verse 4, he says, "One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever." And we might say, well, that doesn't really exemplify any great wisdom or knowledge. It's a fairly obvious thing. One generation passes away, another generation comes, but the earth keeps on going. So there's nothing really dramatic about his conclusion at this point. He also observed, "The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose." And that was a natural observation in his day. The sun rose in the east and struggled its way across the sky and then went out of sight. And the next thing we know, it's back where it started from. Today, tomorrow, the day after, the next day, the day after that, and so on, and so on, and so on. So what really was the purpose behind all this? The sun was just going from there to there, and from there to there, and from there to there, over and over and over again. That was in his day. But of course, we are much more knowledgeable than Solomon, aren't we? Because we know that the earth is round. And in fact, the sun doesn't move at all. We are very knowledgeable. We realize that it's the apparent movement of the sun. So yes, we can boast ourselves that we know even more than what Solomon knew, can't we? Solomon continued to observe the things around him. And he said, all the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. There's a very elevated level of thinking in that expression, isn't there? Yes, the rivers do run into the sea, but the sea never fills up. How can that be? Well, Solomon concluded that therefore, from where the rivers came, the rivers must return again. That was what he concluded. But again, we are more knowledgeable than Solomon, aren't we? Because we know all about the water cycle. And we know all about evaporation and condensation and precipitation, don't we? So we are more knowledgeable than Solomon. Wow, aren't we knowledgeable? Aren't we wise? Solomon continued, the eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. Very astute observations. The eye is not satisfied with seeing. I can't help but think why that statement is not also true today. If Solomon said that, then how much more truthful is it today? The eye is not satisfied with seeing. In a word, tourism. Tourism. How many places on our present globe, not just cities, but countries, depend upon tourism for their livelihood? Yes, people can't stop wanting to see things. I've got to go and see it. I've got to go and see it. Did you see this? Did you see that? And just so you can see it more than once, you take a photograph so that you can see it again. Yes, wasn't Solomon astute in observing that the eye is not satisfied with seeing? The yearning to keep seeing things continues. And then he says, nor the ear filled with hearing. Isn't that remarkable? How much sound goes into one's ear? And yet the ear is not full. I mean, if we pour water into a glass, we can only pour a certain amount of water into the glass before the glass starts to overflow. When did you last see an ear overflowing with sound? It's a miracle, isn't it? The sound keeps going in and in and in. And the ear is never full. It is amazing. Now, of course, we know more than what Solomon did, don't we? We know all about the oral canal, and we know about the three little tubes that give you balance and all that. And now we're able to make a bionic ear. I mean, we are so, so clever. And that's one of the challenges which confronts us. Let us think for a moment about what the Apostle Paul wrote to Timothy. O Timothy, keep that which is committed to thy trust, avoiding profane and vain babblings, and oppositions of science falsely so called, which some professing have erred concerning the faith. there are some important points in this advice that the Apostle Paul gave to Timothy. O Timothy. The Greek word translated there has the significance of an exclamation, an emphasis. O Timothy, what I am going to tell you is very, very important. O Timothy, keep that which is committed to thy trust. Now the word keep means more than just looking after. It also means being on guard. Being on guard. Be on guard to protect that which you have been given, that which has been committed to your trust. And we think of Timothy as a young man and the ministry which he inherited. What did Paul say to him? Preach the word. Be instant, in season, out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with all long-suffering and doctrine. And so when Paul wrote to Timothy, O Timothy, keep that which is committed to thy trust, he's saying, be on guard. And that, of course, implies that someone else might come and try to whittle away some of the great treasures which had been invested in Timothy. Preach the word. Be instant, in season, and out of season. And then he says, avoiding profane and vain babblings. Avoid profane and vain babblings. Avoid them. Avoid them. And the meaning of avoid is to turn away. In other words, don't even bother contending or contesting some of the suppositions. Avoid profane and vain babblings. As soon as we recognize that something is man's wisdom, in inverted commas, which will have the power to encroach upon that which has been committed to our trust, the proper course of action for us is to avoid them, turn away, realizing that they are not from a spiritual viewpoint. And then he says, oppositions of science falsely so called. The falsely so called applies to the scientific explanations and conclusions which are false. The opposition is not false. The opposition is real. But the admonition to Timothy was to avoid the oppositions of science, falsely so called. Now, that often means that Bible students generally, and I've heard this many times, Bible students are inclined to think that there is no connection or no place for science in the Christian faith. And particularly amongst Bible students, we have to rule out science completely. Brethren, that is false. There is a very real place for science in Bible studentship. But the science is not a false prediction. The problem is that there is so much false science around. Just 1 week ago today, last Sunday, I had the privilege of talking with a young gentleman who had just been given his Doctor of Philosophy, a PhD, in cancer research. And so I was keen to talk to him about his scientific studies. And it was just impossible, absolutely impossible, to get him to think of anything other than the evolutionary chain. And the research which he is currently doing is to looking at some of the cells in the brain and tracing them back 200,000 or 300,000 years to some of the early species in the hope that they will be able to identify some hereditary connection, and therefore they might be able to cure cancer today. So I asked him, I said, I have had some scientific training myself years ago. I was just finishing my scientific study when DNA was just about to be discovered. Well, it had been discovered. They thought they'd found this magical molecule. It was called the molecule of life. Now, I'm talking about the late 1950s. So that's 50 years ago, plus. So don't get me wrong, things have changed since then, but I'm just telling you what I experienced. And I said, well, since the discovery of this magical DNA, I would like to know much more about it. I said, I am amazed that they take samples from corpses and from numerous objects and tissues and so on that have been dead for quite some time. And they believe that they can analyse that and identify the DNA, and that gives them some information about the ancestry of that particular organ. I said, does DNA keep going forever? Doesn't it deteriorate like the rest of the human body? And he said, well, it does a bit, you know. It does a bit. But he said, we know where we are, and we're very confident that we're on the right track. Now, let me think about that for a moment. Radioactivity. Radioactivity and radiocarbon dating was also very much in the limelight when I was doing my scientific study. Some of the suggestions there were absolutely unbelievable. I'll just tell you one. Now, I'm telling you what was scientific thinking in the 1950s. I'm not saying it's still there today. It might well have changed. I haven't kept up. I acknowledge that. But we always think of radioactivity as being uranium. But there are many elements which are radioactive. And one of them is tin. There is a radioactive isotope of tin. At least there was in my day. Now, when the tin molecule degenerates, deteriorates, it changes into lead. And so the scientists, big breakthrough here. If we can measure the proportion of tin in the world and the proportion of lead in the world, then obviously all the lead came from the tin. Really? As truly as I stand here, brethren, that was the contention in the late 1950s. At least, that's what I was taught. That is a supposition, false supposition of science, which of course is quite different to proper science, where observations are properly analysed and proper conclusions are drawn. So I think what Paul was saying here to Timothy, oppositions of science, falsely so-called, let us not be caught away with all of these scientific theories. And then Paul says, which some professing have erred from the faith. Brethren, isn't that true? Which some professing have erred concerning the faith. The theory of evolution, for example, has permeated such a large number or large proportion of Christian endeavour in the world today. I believe that the theory of evolution is also false. Let me give you an example. A few years ago, Dawn and I were in Northern Territory, and Long story short, there was a chap there giving a lecture to a group of young people. And he said, now, of course, these rocks, you know, we know how old they are because we have the radiocarbon dating, and they are about 225 million years. And then one of the young people in the group said, oh, excuse me, no, the latest research shows that they are only 175,000 years old. And the lecturer chap said, oh, is that right? He said, well, he said to the guy, he said, well, how old do you think they are? He said, oh, about 190. Right? A supposition of science falsely so called. And brethren, that's where something just creeps in to that which we have been entrusted with, the word of truth. So then, having said all of that, isn't the advice in Hebrews 2 relevant to our day? Therefore, we ought to give the more earnest heed to the things which we have heard, lest at any time we should let them slip. Yes, we need to be on guard. We need to be on guard to make sure that all of these little insinuations and widely accepted understandings don't erode our understanding of the truth. How important is that? Now, these things which we have heard, the writer goes on to say, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord, and was confirmed unto us by them that heard him, the apostles. God also bearing them witness, both with signs and wonders and divers miracles and gifts of the Holy Spirit, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord. Yes, I am come that they might have life. Behold, today is born unto you a Saviour, glad tidings of great joy. And they were confirmed unto us by those that heard him. And the ministry, the message that they gave, was testified with signs and wonders. The dead are raised, the lepers walk, the blind see, the deaf hear. Miraculous signs and wonders. And yes, today, scientists have developed the bionic ear. A marvellous invention, certainly. But they are about 2,000 years behind the times in terms of what Jesus and the apostles was able to do. So then, brethren, the advice in Hebrews 10 and 35. Cast not away, therefore, your confidence, which hath great recompense of reward. Cast not away, therefore, your confidence, which hath great recompense of reward. For yet a little while, and he that shall come, and will not tarry. And then, brethren, we will be able to rejoice, because our knowledge will be far greater than it is today. And while we wait, let us not err concerning the truth, due to these false assumptions of science, so-called.